Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines Israel's decision to block two Muslim U.S. congresswomen's travel to visit the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank. Matt Harvey of the group Never Again Action Rhode Island, who recounts his group's recent civil disobedience protest at an ICE detention facility where a corrections officer deliberately tried to drive through a line of activists, injuring two. And Scott Marks, lead labor organizer with New Haven Rising, who explains how community pressure succeeded in winning a major job commitment from Yale University for neighborhoods of need. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
India's Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi has stripped the disputed region of Kashmir of its autonomous powers. In the days before the crackdown, Modi sent thousands of troops into Indian-controlled Kashmir and urged tourists to leave. Article 370 of India's constitution gave long-term Kashmir residents special rights, including the right to own property. During the crackdown, hundreds of activists and Kashmir officials were detained or placed under house arrest, and communications, including the internet, were blocked. In a television address, Modi insisted Kashmir's special autonomy in Article 370 bred separatism, terrorism, and corruption. With a majority Muslim population, Kashmir has been a point of conflict since India and Pakistan declared independence in 1947. An insurgency has claimed many lives there over the last 30 years. 40 Indian soldiers were killed in a suicide attack carried out by a Pakistan-based militant group on February 14th this year, which almost triggered a third war between the two nuclear-armed nations. Modi's nationalist Bhartiya Janata Party, or BJP, has long sought to impose direct rule on Kashmir and end land rights for Kashmiris. In recent years, a majority of people in the Kashmir Valley strongly supported the establishment of an independent state rather than aligning itself with India or Pakistan. In 1948, the United Nations called for a public plebiscite over the status of Kashmir, but it never took place. 2 years ago, restaurant manager Alec Rashawn Smith, who had type 1 diabetes, died only days after he stopped taking insulin. 1 month's supply of insulin now costs $1,300, more than the money in Rashawn's bank account. With the steep rise in the cost of insulin medication, activists are mobilizing to support the Insulin for All campaign, which has targeted big pharma drug manufacturers like Eli Lilly, and testified before Congress. Today, 7 million Americans require daily insulin treatment for type 1 diabetes. Any interruption in taking insulin can be life-threatening. According to the American Prospect, prices for insulin, developed in the 1920s, remained affordable for decades until the cost skyrocketed in the 1980s and 90s with the introduction of a new generation of the drug. Aggressive marketing by Eli Lilly led doctors and providers to prescribe the costliest medications. So-called pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, act on behalf of insurance companies to negotiate with the drug industry as a group, which theoretically gives them more leverage to buy in bulk. But there's mounting evidence that this isn't how PBMs work. Because they often get paid in rebates from drug manufacturers, they're incentivized to keep prices high, the opposite of what they are designed to do. Health activists are now calling for uninterrupted access to insulin for all patients, which would require government intervention rather than relying on rebates offered by Big Pharma. During the primary campaign season, Democratic presidential candidates have always made a point of showing up at union halls and playing up their ties to working people. Despite declining membership, unions will still play a critical role in the 2020 campaign, both providing vital funding and recruiting volunteers to work at phone banks and knock on doors. Leading candidates, including Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Kamala Harris, have strong ties with labor, while Sanders is urging his supporters to turn out in solidarity to back labor strikes. Today, unions are pushing Congress to enact the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act, to boost workers' rights in the face of well-funded anti-union tactics like captive meetings and firing striking workers. The PRO Act, among other things, would eliminate so-called right-to-work laws, ban permanent strike replacements, legalize secondary boycotts and picketing, and broaden the definition of employee to include many current independent contractors. Jane McAlevey, a former union organizer and author, says the labor movement should back a presidential candidate in 2020 who will defend the right of workers to be on strike and use the full resources of the federal government to aid workers in reclaiming some of what's deserved by the working class. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After initially granting permission for two U.S. Congresswomen, Representatives Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, to travel to Israel, the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reversed itself and blocked the two Muslim lawmakers from visiting the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank for a fact-finding mission. The imposition of a travel ban on the two outspoken critics of Israel came soon after a message was sent by President Trump to Israel via Twitter, which read, quote, "It would show great weakness if Israel allowed the two lawmakers to visit." Israel's decision to block travel by U.S. legislators at the behest of an American president is unprecedented, and Israel came in for scorching bipartisan criticism, even from longtime allies such as AIPAC, the staunchly pro-Israel lobby group. The Israeli government responded by granting Representative Tlaib permission to visit her 90-year-old grandmother in the West Bank if she agreed not to promote the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement while in the country. Initially, Ms. Tlaib accepted, but later rejected the offer, renouncing the oppressive conditions set. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here she discusses President Trump's role in Israel's decision to block the two congresswomen's travel, Israel's view that the BDS movement is linked with a terrorist security threat, and the current human rights conditions for Palestinians that the lawmakers had planned to investigate.
Trump did admit later that he had talked to some people over there. He didn't specify that it was Netanyahu, but it was pretty clearly including either Netanyahu personally or people very close to him. And then he sent this public tweet saying that if Israel allowed the two congresswomen in, it would look like Israel was very weak. It would make Israel look weak. And that was his message to Netanyahu, who immediately said, oh, we're not going to let them in. And, oh, by the way, we have a law that says we don't have to let in anybody who supports the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which uses nonviolent political and economic pressure on Israel to try and get it to end its violations of international law. And he's right about that. 2 years ago, the Israeli Knesset did pass a law that says that Israel has the right to reject the entry of anyone who supports BDS. Of course, that's used not consistently. It's used when it's useful. And in this case, it was used against the two congresswomen. Now, the significance of it was kind of on three different levels. At the immediate level, the notion of a U.S. president calling on a foreign leader to deny access to their country of elected members of the U.S. Congress was absolutely unprecedented, absolutely unprecedented. Number two, this is something that was not the first time Israel has denied people entry. Of course, you need to go through Israeli checkpoints, whether it's the airport or the bridge over the Jordan River, to enter the Israeli-occupied West Bank or Gaza Strip, unless you go in from Egypt, which almost never happens, into Gaza. But for the West Bank, you have to go through Israeli control. So Israel controls who can and cannot get into the Palestinian territory. So even if somebody said, I don't want to go to Israel, I only want to go to the West Bank, there's no way to do that without going through Israeli-controlled entryways. So in that sense, what Israel did to Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar happens every day, every day, every day, to Palestinians, to Palestinian rights activists, to people who might be perceived to be Palestinian rights activists, even if they're not, and get held accountable. So the denial of entrance is a constant threat. So the kind of humiliation, the kind of expression of power is a constant in the lives of Palestinians. The third thing is the more long-term question, and that is the degree to which this alliance between Israel and the U.S., this partnership between Netanyahu and Trump, is situated in the midst of a rising right-wing, what we might call an axis of authoritarianism. You know, this is a set of ethno-populists and dictators around the world who are looking to Trump for support, for enabling, sometimes for money, for arms sales. So you have governments from Brazil, with Bolsonaro calling for killing people in the street, to Duterte in the Philippines, who is killing people in the streets, the roundup of journalists in Turkey, the role of absolute monarchs in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So all of these things are happening in the context of the rise of Trump as someone who is providing political support, diplomatic protection, arms sales, denial of the importance of human rights, all these things that is enabling the consolidation of power by these very right-wing forces all around the world.
Phyllis, long before this media coverage of Israel's decision to impose this travel ban on these two congresswomen, Israel, in creating their law that allows them to ban the travel of people who support BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, has equated BDS with terrorism. And I heard that over and over again this past week, where Israeli officials were basically claiming that advocates and supporters of BDS are, in fact, doing the bidding of terrorists and are in league with terrorism.
Yeah, I didn't hear as much of the equation of BDS with terrorism. BDS is generally condemned by Israeli officials as being designed to delegitimize Israel and to deny the right of Israel to exist, that it opposes a two-state solution, et cetera, et cetera. None of which, of course, is true. I mean, if people had read the actual statement of the BDS movement, it's very clear. It speaks to three specific violations of international law. Those being the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, the denial of equal rights to Palestinian citizens of Israel who maintain citizenship, they can get a passport, they have the right to vote, but because a lot of rights in the Israeli system are based on nationality rather than citizenship, their citizenship rights are second, third, or fourth class. And then thirdly, the denial of the right of return of Palestinian refugees. So all three of those are direct violations of international law and human rights, of course. And BDS basically says we will use boycotts and divestment campaigns and sanctions to pressure Israel to end those violations. It very clearly does not take a position on states. It's about rights. It's not about states. So it's a complete fabrication that it's a denial of one or another position on states. It's also a fabrication to link it to anything other than nonviolent action.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her article titled Israel's Ban on Tlaib and Omar shows Netanyahu and Trump's contempt for democracy was published in the August 17th edition of Newsweek magazine. Find a link to that article and more analysis and commentary on Israel's blocking the two lawmakers' travel by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On the evening of August 14th, members of the Jewish activist group Never Again Action were engaged in a peaceful civil disobedience protest against Trump regime ICE immigration policies at the Wyatt Detention Facility in Central Falls, Rhode Island. Shortly before 10 p.m., a pickup truck approached at a rapid rate of speed. After initially stopping, the driver pushed forward as people screamed. Two people injured by the truck were later taken to the hospital. After corrections officers at the privately owned facility came out to the parking lot and used pepper spray against the activists, three other people were taken to the hospital, where they were treated for exposure to the caustic chemical. The driver of the truck, Captain Thomas Woodworth, was quickly placed on administrative leave, and a day later he resigned his position from the detention facility. The incident remains under active investigation by the Rhode Island State Police and is also under internal investigation by the owner of the detention center. At a press conference on August 20th, members of Never Again Action decried the violent attack on peaceful protesters that occurred at the detention center and called on Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo and the General Assembly to take whatever steps are necessary to shut down the riot immediately and release all ICE detainees currently held there. Your reporter spoke with Matt Harvey, an organizer with Never Again Action, who recounts the events that occurred during the group's August 14th protest, while observing that the violence visited upon peaceful protesters in a public place is likely an indicator of the kinds of violence the ICE contracted staff feel empowered to inflict on the vulnerable immigrants and asylum seekers in their care in the prison.
So the Wyatt is a privately operated prison located in Central Falls, Rhode Island. It is the only location in the state where ICE detainees are currently held. Never Again Action Rhode Island had a protest and an action at the Wyatt in early July. There were a couple hundred people who attended a protest. We had a number of protesters who, in an act of civil disobedience, quite literally shut the facility down, using their bodies to block the entrances and exits to the prison so that no vehicles could enter or exit. It was a very successful and very peaceful protest. There was really no violence or anything to speak of. 18 people were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct for that civil disobedience. And I think the success of that event, we were able to shut the facility down for an evening, and the turnout we had encouraged us to go back and try to do it again, which is where we found ourselves last Wednesday.
As most of our listeners will know, one of the corrections officers there at the facility attempted to drive through the line of peaceful protesters who were blocking the entrance, and at least two people I'm aware of were injured. But tell us exactly what happened, if you would.
Sure. The event started, again, very similar to the event we held in July. It was a peaceful and a really, I think, a great event. We had more people attend. By some estimates, 400 to 500 people marched from a local park over to the Wyatt facility. For several hours, there were speeches from rabbis and other faith leaders, from leaders of the immigrant community, from other leaders of the community. We presented a list of demands to the leadership of the Wyatt, or I should say, we attempted to present a list of demands to the leadership of the Wyatt, asking for more transparency about who was held there and under what conditions. They refused to meet with us. And so we repeated the same civil disobedience actions that we'd taken the first time around, where we blocked entrances to the prison. We arrived at the facility around 7 o'clock. By about 9 p.m., we shifted the focus to actually block two entrances to the staff parking lot. For about 45 minutes, we uneventfully blocked the entrances to those parking lots until about 10 minutes till 10, when entirely out of nowhere, a pickup truck came down the road and swerved into the parking lot directly at the line of protesters who were seated across it. And I'm sure you and others have seen the video. It was a really scary scene. People jumped up, tried to block the truck. Two people had to go to the hospital because of injuries from the truck itself. After the truck, you know, drove into that line and sort of gunned itself forward and was surrounded by our protesters, a group of other guards from the prison came running down, surrounded the truck, shoved folks out of the way, and then pepper sprayed the crowd somewhat indiscriminately. As I said, two people went to the hospital because of injuries from the truck itself. Another three people went to the hospital just from the pepper spray, and many more people were incapacitated and were being treated on the scene by EMTs because of the pepper spray that the guards used. It was a really scary scene and very unexpected. To our knowledge, this is the first time that any Never Again protest anywhere in the country has had some kind of a violent incident like this.
Tell us a bit about what's happened to this particular captain. I believe his name is Captain Thomas Woodworth, who was driving that truck.
On the night of the event, of the attack, absolutely nothing happened to Captain Woodworth. He was protected by his colleagues, and local police didn't make any move to even question, much less arrest him. Very quickly after the event, the state police and the state attorney general announced they were opening an investigation. The Wyatt announced that Kathleen Woodworth had been placed on administrative leave. And then a day later, it was announced that he had resigned. Obviously, we're pleased that he's resigned because we're glad that he's no longer working there. From our perspective, that's really just a first step. We believe that he should face criminal charges for assaulting these protests with his truck. In the wake of Charlottesville, that's something that has to be taken very seriously. That was an extremely dangerous thing to do. We also believe that the other guards who used pepper spray on a crowd of innocent protesters, including a woman in her 70s, should potentially face charges for their actions. But we also want to take a step back and recognize that while the action of this one guard and his colleagues were certainly awful, it's worth putting in context, this is the kind of violence they were willing to enact on a group of peaceful protesters who were mostly white in front of cameras. Given that, it's not hard to imagine how much worse the violence is inside that facility where these guards don't have the scrutiny they had that night. This, for us, shines a light on why we're protesting in the first place. The immigration machine, from the border to wherever folks are being detained, is a whole system that is violent at its core and one that needs to be shut down.
That was Matt Harvey, a spokesperson and organizer with Never Again Action Rhode Island. Learn more about the group and the August 14th incident at the Wyatt Detention Facility by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 12th, the Connecticut-based labor community organizing group New Haven Rising celebrated a written agreement with Yale University to provide 1,000 jobs to city residents, including 600 jobs in so-called neighborhoods of need, that is, the city's Black and Latinx neighborhoods, as well as pathways to a continuing pipeline of jobs through education and training. Yale has already hired 300 people from the city's communities of color in need of jobs. During their campaign, New Haven Rising allied themselves with Yale's labor unions, Locals 34 and 35, and the university's graduate teachers, organized as Local 33, who are still fighting for their first contract. New Haven Rising also had support on the city's 30-member Board of Alders, where the Black and Hispanic Caucus had declared a jobs crisis in the city. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Scott Marks, lead labor organizer with New Haven Rising, who summarizes the five-year history of the struggle and what the campaign accomplished.
The most exciting thing is the sort of training and the development of leaders and how to run a meeting, how to build relationships and grow the committee. So that was one of the greatest rewards, to see people move forward and be able to stay focus till we got to the set of goals. And the set of goals for us was to try to get 500 jobs in the neighborhoods of need. We had a real series of knocking on doors and a big action. And basically, Yale came to the conclusion that they were going to give the jobs, but not by the zip codes. And we did more work because we didn't settle for not having the jobs go to where they were most needed. And there, you know, was an end period of the agreement, and that was April 2019, and we weren't quite there yet. All along the way, we did area bill meetings where we brought the community together. We would sort of do it in the different neighborhoods, and basically the union and community leaders would come together so that we could keep reporting on the progress and coming up with ideas to keep the campaign alive. We wanted to be working with Local 33, the graduate teachers, that they actually get recognized as a union. And then the regular contracts for 34 and 35 were coming up, and we were working on the project New Haven Rising to deliver more jobs to the hardest hit neighborhood. So that is a short version of a really long story.
Scott Marks, what exactly did Yale agree to?
Well, basically, Yale, working with the Yale unions, agreed that there would be a number of ways for people. For example, there is people who have a lot of the skills. They're not quite there, but there's a gateway tuition that would be provided in this agreement and a $1,000 stipend. There will be opportunities from Eli Whitney, the trade school for New Haven residents, to sort of come on to Yale and get their hours, and a push on when they do development to sort of make sure that we're introducing more people into the trades. There are apprenticeships. There's multiple things in Local 34. There's the opportunity for the department to get a boost on giving someone a shot to come into that department, and Yale has ponied up some of the cost of that salary, and then that's a good way to get into Yale.
What's next for New Haven Rising?
Making sure that we're actually getting the different slots for the different opportunities that exist through this agreement, getting the people in and making sure that we're continuing to work with Yale, that we stay on target to sort of have the benefit. And then the thing is, these pathways, new ways for people to actually access jobs at Yale. And the hope is over and above the 300 more, but continuing to be involved, work together, continue to build power, because basically when you make agreements, they're, you know, as good as the paper that they exist on, but to make sure that we're staying focused and Yale holding the community accountable and the community continuing to hold Yale accountable.
That was Scott Marks, lead labor organizer with the group New Haven Rising. For more information on the campaign that pressured Yale University to hire city residents, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.